what we're seeing now, the first wave of AI is bolted onto the side of that form is this AI. Well, that's cool. It can look at the form and it can help me fill out the form. But the next stage of this will be that there is no form. I don't need a form anymore. I'm going to log in and it's just going to be my AI business application.
Welcome to the Leaders of B2B podcast, a weekly show where we bring you interviews and in-the-weeds expertise with today's B2B experts and thought leaders. You can see more about today's episode and guest by visiting our website at leadersofb2b.com.
Hey, leaders, welcome back. This is Ledge. Today, I'm excited to have a real MVP. We'll tell you all about that. Steve Mordu calling in from Brazil. Steve, welcome. I'd love it. You'd give an intro. Anybody that Googled Steve, you're going to know all things about his outstanding footprint. But Steve, what are your favorite things? What are you working on? What's important right now?
Right now, I'd say I'm working on trying to slow down. I've been going so fast for so long. And I think maybe moving to Brazil has been part of that because things are a little slower here and a little more laid back. And it's not as easy to travel from here to places. So I don't find myself traveling as much. So really right now, my focus is on continuing what I'm doing, but letting the team, I'm becoming a better delegator than I have been in the past.
And what's your key area of work? Because when I look at it, it's like you have a whole portfolio of activities, which I think is endemic to the entrepreneurial minds. That doesn't surprise me. A lot of people I talk to are in that space. What's the connective tissue there? You have ForceWorks Global and you're CEO of that. And there's a lot of other things going on too. So what's the picture of your activities? Describe the arena.
Yeah, we are ForceWorks Global is a company that was originally a Salesforce.com consulting company. That's how we got the name ForceWorks. It was a play on words. We moved over to Microsoft when they first launched their CRM product, Dynamics Online. It had been on-premise before, but when they launched it as an online product, we got interested and came over and joined Microsoft ecosystem back then. So we primarily are working with businesses that are using CRM systems for tracking sales, tracking service, other sorts of things that they're doing with Microsoft products. We saw a few opportunities in our journey to create some IP, create some apps. Some of these applications that come from Microsoft, they're really targeting large customers. So they tend to be a little complicated. And there's a large segment of the market that is not large and is looking for things that are a little easier to use. So we saw an opportunity to make some simpler to use versions of their great big apps. And that's under a brand we call Rapid Start, which is another property that we have. Really, two parts of our business today is the Rapid Start apps, which we sell at a fairly low cost. The real goal of our business is providing services to customers, helping them take either our app or Microsoft's app and do more with it, get more value out of it. So that's what I'm focused on today. We've got a team of about 30 of us spread all over the world. One of the things I definitely love about being in the cloud business, and it allowed me to just pick up and move to Brazil and not miss a beat, because as long as you got internet, you can work from anywhere in this kind of business. I feel for people that have to actually go to an office to do a job. And I feel very fortunate to be, you know, one of those that's in a space where I can do it from anywhere.
Things have taken a little bit of a shift that direction. And there's the deep pull of some people and individuals and companies to let's all get back together in this really expensive commercial real estate. And I'm more like you, you know, I'll have the virtual version of the office behind me on Zoom and I'm good to go. So I feel that.
I've been virtual now for quite a while. I had an office in downtown Tampa where I spent most of my life and career and had a bunch of people in this office. I don't know, it's 5,000 square feet of space. We're running in this office building. And I came in one day and it just struck me as I was standing at the door looking in one of the rooms. I had two people sitting in adjacent cubicles talking to each other on Skype. They're literally 3 feet apart, separated by a wall, a little carpeted wall, and they're talking to each other on Skype. And it occurred to me right at that moment that they could be doing that from home. There isn't any reason for them to have to come in here and sit in this cubicle. So I called a team meeting, got everybody together, and I said, listen, anybody who would prefer to work from home, this was early days, this was probably 10, 12, 13 years ago. As anybody that prefer to work from home and just do Skype, you're welcome to, no problem. And then I adjourned the meeting. I came in the next morning and no one was there. Everybody took me up on the offer and all started working from home. And I remember sitting there in this great big empty office space by myself. I had another 8 months on the lease term. So I went in there every day because I like to get out of the house. But yeah, so I was sitting in this empty office for 8 months until the lease ran out so I could get out of it. Now, I've been remote work ever since.
It's the Steve co-working option.
Exactly. Yeah, I should have done something with the space. I had it for 8 months, but selling all the furniture out just to get rid of stuff and clear the place out.
I can harken back to the days where we were early 2000s fighting the corporate machine on. They didn't want us to use any type of messaging software. You had to do email. And everybody was like, to hell with this. And installing AIM or some other tool. And we're all doing business on this AOL network, which now just sounds completely insane. But it's just, you couldn't fight that instinct. It was just a better way to do it. Now video and asynchronous video. And it's just, it's funny looking back. I started a business on the first version of Google Apps and all my workers like, this sucks. I want to use Office. I'm like, no, look at this. It was the collaboration ability of just working on the same thing. And I think, but I do remember the funny thing, like your Skype story, I remember distinctly that you could tell who was talking in the office by the pattern of keystrokes as who was chatting back and forth with each other four or five desks away.
Tick, tick, tick.
And when it was like you could measure the sound and then the laughter would go back and forth. So you knew it wasn't working.
Yeah. I know. Obviously, you're familiar with the term shadow IT. And that basically where that stuff started as a management of an organization. When you try and lock people down, people don't like to be locked down and they will find a way around. And shadow IT, we still see it today all the time going into organizations where we're talking to them about a CRM and I say, do you have a CRM? No, we don't have anything. I'm realizing, yeah, you do. There's 12 people in here that are using some free tool from the internet for CRM and they had no idea.
Yeah, right.
No idea.
That's exactly right. And I remember, this is still funny to me because I remember that this organization was so against shared documentation, which is just like, what? That we built a server and stuck it behind a desk and ran a contraband wiki on it so that we could actually do our jobs.
Yeah, people are, employees in particular, they're like water. They will find a way. And you can put up the dam, you can block it with trees, you can do whatever you want, but that water is going to get around it somehow. The question is whether you're aware of how it's gotten around it or not, whether you're part of it or you're just going to have this happen behind your back.
Are you the dam or are you the water? Because I can tell you.
Exactly. Yeah. I definitely have noticed in the past several years a pretty significant change in that mentality. I think it was a management style that is falling out of favor. I think that management organizations that have opened up and embraced collaboration, embraced information sharing, and embraced this stuff have seen benefit, and other corporations are not following suit. We've been seeing this shift over the last, decade maybe, from this really locked up tight. There's still some of those around, but those people are going to die off soon.
Yeah, and BYOD and all these things. It's just like unavoidable, right? Everybody has a supercomputer in their pocket. Like to think that they're not going to use that to do their jobs. And off mic, we were talking about AI and it's just like the sea change that is going on here. And the first people that are going to be in deep, deep trouble are probably middle management or somebody. If your job's called analyst, I'd be a little concerned right now that like, this is...
It certainly is being presented as an aid to people. But if you recall, that's how factory robots were also presented, was an aid to workers. And now you've got factories that are completely run by robots. There's like two guys sitting in an office somewhere just watching a wall of lights to make sure the robots are all operating. And there used to be 300 people in that building. So the difference, I think, on the AI side is it's not going to attack the low-skilled labor market. This is going to go after people in office workers at every level, from certainly customer support. You've got these massive call centers operating all over the place, all over the world, massive call centers that are on the verge of going to be replaced by AI agents that will just be more efficient, be faster, never take a vacation, never take any time off, never ask for a raise. In fact, don't get paid anything.
And we'll always have access to 100% of the information and can take autonomous agent actions. And
exactly.
You look at that as a user, you go, well, yeah, that's a lot better. And of course, you have both sides of that saying, for example, I'm never going to hire an analyst. I could do my job better having a tool next to me that could do things that I just wasn't net new going to do with a human because I didn't want to afford that. So I think there's also an expansion factor in that sense, aiding because I wouldn't hire that person anyway. But there's the replacement factor of a lot of people. And then even like from a technology standpoint, look at a ubiquitous software like a CRM. I say you all must be thinking about that. Ultimately, if I never need to update a UI with anything because all my calls just get auto-analyzed and logged properly, and it flags me automatically based on the next thing that I should do, then what's a CRM? It's just you're in this like existential redefinition of everything.
I saw this cartoon that I thought was hilarious. On one side is this woman sitting on a computer talking to coworkers about how I just use AI to expand my 5 bullet points into a nice big email. And then on the other side is the recipient telling her people that I just used AI to summarize this great big email into 5 bullet points. So well, we're going to be in that space where very soon I'm looking at some of the things happening in online meeting technology and areas like that. As I mentioned in the pre-show, I was actually watching the video of ChatGPT 4.0, which is launched today. So anybody wants to figure out when this podcast was, it was on the day that was launched. And that is looking pretty amazing. I can remember having a website and thinking about putting a chatbot on it at the time. A while back when it first came out, we're crude, and I think it was actually even live chat. And I remember, I think it's a generational thing, because my father at the time was saying, I would never use that. If they don't have a phone number, I'm not doing business with them. He wouldn't email. If you didn't have your 800 number on a website, you were not going to do business with them. Now, we don't even have our phone number on the website.
I don't want my phone number on a website, like ever.
Yeah. When I click that chat box, I'm hoping there's not a person there. I really just want to go through an automated process. I don't want to go through dealing with an individual now. And that experience is going to be exponentially better than it has been already. So I definitely, as a user, I have no need for your phone number. I have no need for a person on the other end of this chat. I just need answers to my questions and I'm gone.
So how do you grok that as you run a B2B consulting company? Sure, there's technology, but ultimately, what's a consultant if not access to information and formats and templates? And where does that go?
Yeah, I'm hoping I retire before it hits us. It's coming to everybody, right? We've got unique knowledge today, but it's not knowledge that isn't out there and couldn't be consumed by a large language model trained on all the Microsoft stuff that we've learned and know, and all the partner blogs about everything out there. And there certainly will come a day, and I'm sure Microsoft can hardly wait for that to come, where you're just going to log into a Copilot and say, hey, I think I want a CRM system. Can you build it for me? And I want it to do this and that and the other, and it will just build it for you, and guys like me will have nothing to do. I think the other thing we're going to see from AI, which may come even sooner than that, is a completely different form factor of what we're used to. Right now, when you look at a CRM system or lots of systems out there, they're essentially forms over data, right? You're logging into a website, you're clicking on something and it's popping up a form of information. You can add to it, you can create a new one. You're really just looking at forms of information. And that's been the model forever, basically, ever since software came out for any sort of business application, ERP, CRM, any of those sorts of things. But what we haven't, and what we're seeing now, the first wave of AI is bolted onto the side of that form is this AI. Well, that's cool. It can look at the form and it can help me fill out the form. But the next stage of this will be that there is no form. I don't need a form anymore. I'm going to log in and it's just going to be my AI business application. I'm going to, who do I need to call to
If it's OpenAI, it's going to be a big black dot and you just talk to it.
Exactly. It's going to be, we're moving towards an AI first development. We're not there yet, right? It's happening in the back rooms, but right now we're still AI bolted on to legacy stuff. But the next stage will be apps that were built from AI first to do things. And yeah, as a salesperson, you're going to come in and say, what do I need to do today? Oh, who do I need to call? But please get them on the phone. Please tell them this. And please let me know the result. No, I've suddenly become irrelevant.
You talk about being, you know, later in your career and maybe you'll be out soon, which means that you've got an accumulation of having watched sea changes over the course of 30 years. And does anything strike you from that collection of activities like the change that we're seeing now?
I would love to say it was only 30 years, but it's been longer than that. I've never been employed by anyone. I took over my father's small sign company when I was 18 years old because he sold the value out of it and gave me the remnants. And I've been an entrepreneur basically ever since then. Yeah, these were well before cell phones. We're talking about fax machine was the common tool for passing stuff back and forth. You go to some convention and you get the big line of phones on the walls and everybody's running out between sessions, lines at these phones. So there's been some pretty big changes. Obviously, internet was another one before the internet. I can't even remember how the hell we did business before the internet. You were on the phone calling someone up to try and get a meeting. You had to go to their office to meet with them to have them tell you no. Everything was just so much more work in hindsight, though it didn't feel like it at the time. But I think the internet was the first big change to hit business, and mobile phones was the second. And I'm going to have to put this up there as at that kind of caliber, what's happening with AI and what's going to happen with AI. I think it's in that same category of internet and mobile phones. So we will see. But it has definitely been an interesting ride watching these technologies come along. And I've always been one of those that was an early adopter, which usually is not the best place to be. You find yourself throwing a lot of money away on stuff that ends up not being adopted and learning a bunch of information about something that you're not going to need because it didn't pan out. But
you still have a Laserdisc collection?
Right. The Laserdisc, the Betamax. Yeah, sure. All those things that just didn't make the cut. But you never know what will. And I've just always been curious about stuff. And as an entrepreneur, basically my whole life, I'm always looking for a business advantage. How can I create an event? And I remember my father told me one time, because I was talking about something to do with business, and I was talking about something not being fair or something, and he said, screw fair. He says, this is business. You don't worry about fair. If you see an opportunity to create an unfair advantage, you absolutely take that opportunity every time, because if you don't, they will. So that was probably part of my early interest in technology was, I was competing with a bunch of people. I was young, so I'm competing with a bunch of people who are older and not too quick to embrace technology. I was always ahead of that curve and trying to use technology for competitive advantage.
Being immersed in this technology and business environment, a lot of people started to experience AI as the drop of ChatGPT. Where was it before that for folks like you in the trenches and taking advantage earlier? What was that collection of years before that?
Yeah, AI is not new. Obviously, it's been in science fiction movies since before it was real, but AI is a pretty generic term. But before GPTs, really what we were looking at were things like machine learning, which is a pretty big thing at Microsoft in particular, long before all this stuff came out. And this is the idea of taking a bunch of data that you've got, or a continuous stream of data that you've got, and applying algorithms to it, almost mathematical algorithms to determine probabilities. So it was a very mathematical thing, but at the end of the day, it could give you some insights, which is an overused term, about what's going on based on a bunch of math. And this was really this idea, I think, at the core of what was machine learning. The large language model was a completely different fork. It's a completely different direction than machine learning. I do recall before that talking to lots of customers about AI, and we were talking about machine learning at the time. and having, showing them a demo of, look at all this great information we've gotten about this pile of data that you wouldn't have been able to figure out any other way, but through this automated process, and them all being really amazed at that, but having no idea where to start or how to get it or how to make it work. It was too abstract. They saw the result, but they couldn't figure it. It's like looking at a Rembrandt or something. You can appreciate the painting, but you have no clue how to do it or how to even start. So they would not do anything. And I think what ChatGPT did was it made it all instantly accessible. We were already using chat messengers and things like that. So it had an interface people were comfortable with, and there just wasn't a person on the other end, right? You were chatting with a machine instead of a person, but the UI was familiar, accessible. And I think that's really what caused that thing to blow up. And now it's on everybody's radar because it's accessible. Every company wants it. They don't even know what it is or how it works or how it's going to help them. They just want it. That's been a fun little ride.
Yeah, I came into tech around where people started talking about big data. And then from the big data, cool, we became really awesome at putting all the information somewhere. We just couldn't get it out and do anything with it. And I believe that became the seed for, you know, well, let's try to learn things from endless petabytes of data that we're collecting. And then, oh, it turns out it's not enough to learn things. We need to be able to interact with and
talk to it,
talk to it and ask dumb human questions so the robot can laugh at us and give us instantaneous access to quote unquote original combination of thought, which I think is tremendous. And the interesting thing, and now tell me if this is true, but so you talk about the internet revolutionizing business and mobile devices, so cell phone type of stuff, but did any of that have anywhere near the same launch curve? It seemed like it took, I remember getting my first BlackBerry and then smartphone, and that's 5, 6, 7 years before that became a critical business tool. Is this faster? Is the pace so much more?
I think it will be. And part of the reason is our cost. When mobile phones first came out, I remember buying a Motorola mobile phone. And I got a contract where I paid by the minute for talking. There was no unlimited. You paid by the minute. And as a business person, I was trying to control my talking, but it was still $2,500 a month. We're talking, 20 years ago, it was $2,500 a month cell phone bill. So that will slow down adoption of anything. When competition came to that space, and obviously now with everybody on unlimited data plans and all that sort of stuff, of course, that shot up pretty quick, but it was a slow start because of cost. Internet was the same thing. I remember when internet came out, going to the library to do a little business research. And I would log into CompuServe at the time, and you paid for that by the minute as well. Before you even went to the library, you would go ahead and draft out your entire query of what you were going to ask. Give me a list of these companies in this area, whatever it was.
To go as fast as you could. Yeah, right.
And you'd go sit at the library and you'd punch that in and it would go and spit out a result and you'd turn it off, because that right there just cost you like $150 for a minute of internet time running to generate. So that was another thing that kept that one slow. AI doesn't seem to have that problem. It's GPT-4o is free. You can get some of these things are absolutely free to get access to. That's going to make a huge difference in the adoption curve. Microsoft's got several versions in their house that are, some are paid, but one of the things they're trying to do to differentiate and justify the cost is you don't want your data out there in the world being used by some competitor or some other business who's using some GPT. And so you want to keep your data out of that. And Microsoft's in kind of a unique position to, because they've already got this fence around this data. But now you got a fence around the data and you're out here on ChatGPT, it can't see your data, so it's not helpful. So a lot of what they've been doing with the Copilot strategy is let's have a Copilot that looks at your data. So you can actually ask business about your own business and it's looking at your own data. No one else can see it. Okay, that's worth some money. So they're out there with some paid versions. And
sure. like being able to unstructure query by business, which.
Now we're going to run to the next wall.
I started at a big consulting company out of college, just like everybody my age. And it was like, oh, all the knowledge is in our company already. And you just search Lotus Notes and it was off. It was impossible. You couldn't do it. But that was the theory anyway. And now it would literally be like the company GPT sucked that up and asked the question and it'll tell you the answer. So,
I think this will move much more quickly than other technologies just because of the cost factor. It's too accessible, too cheap, too much competition. We're early in the stage where nobody's really trying to make money yet. They're trying to be the one, the leader, pushing towards AGI and fame and all that sort of stuff that they want to get is more important than money. You got lots of investment dollars pouring in, knowing that there's no money now. Maybe there will be at some point in the future, but they all want to be on that train.
Yeah. Winner take all. I don't know if that's the best model, but we're still going to stick with
winner take all or nothing. All the fame and all the glory, but
there's your dad's unfair advantage, right?
Yeah, exactly. Screw fair.
Let me ask you this. So you are founder, CEO, lifetime kind of entrepreneur. Other people work for you. When I talk about B2B leadership, those are the things that are really interesting for me. You do have to run an enterprise. And at some point, enterprise went from you and maybe somebody else at a kitchen table to global and 30 people all over the place and more and big clients and companies. And just, what are the lessons learned there on that human leadership side that you rest in for your career?
I don't know that I would classify us as an enterprise with 30 people. When I think enterprise, you normally think bigger. But I've had bigger companies in the past. I've been in lots of different kinds of businesses over my career. So you start seeing some common threads. One of the things that has always worked well for me, which was another thing my father completely disagreed with, was I never liked this idea of holding the golden ring out to someone just out of reach. Your goal is to get to this ring. I don't like that kind of motivation for myself, and I didn't really like it that much for employees. So I tended to be more along the line of give them the golden ring and tell them what they need to do to keep it. So I always paid people more than my competitors might pay for the same person, in the idea that I'm giving you this golden ring. Instead of bringing you in cheap and having you slave to try and get to it, I'm going to hand it to you. But now your job is to keep it.
I wish I worked for you instead, earlier career. That would have been better.
I was also pretty quick to fire.
Life
is too short. Yeah. I did between some of my business stuff in the early years, I did a stint as a turnaround consultant. Independent. I was going into companies that had business problems and trying to help them figure out how to solve them. And I wasn't really qualified to do this, but I was young and thought I could figure things out. And it was so obvious to me, so many times walking into companies, what their problem was. You've got people that have been with you for years that are now making lots of money and aren't doing anything. You need to fire Bob. But Bob, he's one of my first employees. Yeah, I know, but you're going out of business and Bob's part of the reason. So it was surprising how often you'd walk into a business that was having financial problems. Lots of these companies back then were on the brink of bankruptcy or in bankruptcy and trying to figure out how to salvage everything. And you just look around and you realize that this plug's out of the wall. Somebody kicked a plug out of the wall. You know, I mean, that's your problem. But some of these things were so obvious and so simple. And I had a lot of success in that business for many years. And people are thinking I was just some kind of a guru. And I'm like, no, this plug's out of the wall over here. Let's just fire Bob. Sorry, Bob, it's you or 500 other people.
So plug that back in, unplug Bob, and you're good.
Yeah. It also teaches you that you have to be a little ruthless. You can be a kind, considerate, easy, approachable person, but you have to be ruthless with people that just aren't helping the organization move forward.
Hire, what do they say? Hire fast, fire faster.
Yep. But part of that hire fast, I always felt, is hire fast, but hire better. Give them a better opportunity than they have at the competitors. There's so many companies out there that I think are trying to find the cheapest people they can. I see that in our community of Dynamics partners. You know, looking for the cheapest people they could possibly find, bring them in, and just try and make as much money off their back as they possibly can. But the problem is with somebody who's come in at that level, you're teaching them stuff. And while you're teaching them stuff, their value is increasing. And they will absolutely leave you to go to a competitor as soon as they know, you know, anything at all. And so you're in this continuous mode of teaching. You're hiring new recruits, constantly training people and losing them. I would say the opposite from an employee standpoint. The idea that you've got security working in a big company is no longer valid. You see, even in our space, big tech companies laying off thousands of people that have been these companies for a long time without giving it a second thought. Job security, I don't think is a real thing anymore. And staying with a company really for more than 2-3 years is probably not doing you any good.
It's not a good choice monetarily or for like you don't have the opportunities. Yeah, so
there are people out there that have the capability to start their own business, but I also know that there are a lot of people that don't. That's just not their thing. They need to be in part of an ecosystem. But to really move up with yourself personally in life, I think you need to switch companies every few years because you're coming into company at this level, you're learning stuff, becoming more valuable, but you came in at this level and you'll always have that kind of hung over your head. Think of a receptionist or something. I don't care if she ends up running the HR department in an enterprise, there will still be people thinking and looking at her as, oh, she was a receptionist. So you leave and you go somewhere else where you aren't starting as a receptionist. You're starting where you ended at the last one. And you keep doing this zigzag up the ladder. And I think that the successful employees in organizations, they all took that path. And they're surrounded by a bunch of people. Hell yeah, I've been here for 30 years. And neither the company or you are any good for that.
Right. I want to go back to something you said because it dovetails to this thinking that I've been doing recently. You talked about the consulting thing, and I get that vibe. Like, I've had that where you walk in and you're like, this is so brain dead. Why can you not see this? And also, I've started to challenge myself on, it's like, what is the unique value or spin around that from my perspective is that I take that for granted. And let me start making a list of the things that I think are brain dead simple that I take for granted, because that's probably the value that I could charge the most money for. And I don't know if that ever occurred to you, but I started changing that mental model to that's so dumb that are like, actually, no, that's my unique genius. Does that resonate with you?
Yeah, I think that particularly when I was younger, I think I was probably 30 years old before I realized that I wasn't actually the smartest person in every room that I entered.
You beat me. I think I made it to 40. So, yeah.
Yeah, because up until that time, you just feel like there's nobody smarter than you. And I guess it's just self-awareness. But as you get into higher echelons and deeper water, you start realizing, hey, there's some other smart people in this room with me. And then eventually you reach the point where you realize, you know what, I'm the dumbest person in this room. I'm surrounded by people that are smarter than me. But then you also learn how to, okay, I can use that to my advantage. I surround myself with smarter people. We as a company organization can do a better job through their efforts. I can do less work. So it's this whole life cycle. You know, you started out as a teenage punk, right? A little smart-ass teenager, as we all of us do. And that carries over for a while. And if you have any kind of early success, it goes straight to your head and explodes. And you are now the smartest person in the room, as far as you're concerned, as far as you can see. And then as the years go on, I wish I was as smart as I was when I was 25.
You know? Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, I've been reading about that too. The way our brains change over time, you move from sharp and innovative to more like teacher mentor type of like second career leadership, which I think is interesting. And I feel myself at that precipice approaching, like this was the first year I was like, I'm more than halfway done. Let me start thinking a little bit different about about this and the experience and the irony of looking back at my young punkness that lasted far into my 30s and just going, man, I was a real jackass to work with. And but blessings to everybody that had to put up with me. I do appreciate the lessons that you tried to beat into me while I was insistent on losing millions of dollars.
Yeah. It's risk, right? And when you're young, you can bet the farm, because if you lose it, you can go make another farm and bet that one and bet that one and bet that one. But as you get older, you start looking at that farm and you say, I think I'm going to hang on to this one. I don't think I'm going to bet this one. You become a little less risk tolerant. As you said, crossing that halfway point is probably about when you start becoming a little less risk tolerant. But oh yeah, in my 20s, I bet the farm over and over and over again. And sometimes I lost and sometimes I won, but I wasn't afraid to bet it. I had a wife and two kids at home at the time. He's still out there betting the farm. If she had any idea, she probably would divorce me much sooner.
Yeah. Those who aren't watching the video version, Steve and I share the same haircut, and I'm guessing he earned it the same way I did. So fantastic. Talk about second to last question. You know, I'm always interested in entrepreneur parents, because I am one, and just like, how does that fit into, when you think back, those are like, if I think now of anything, it's I work and I father. And does that resonate then? And what do you take away once the kids are out there and they're alive and they're adults and businesses growing up around you? Those are all versions of your leadership fatherhood. I'm keen on that topic now in my advancing age too.
I'll have to confess, I don't think I was the best father. I was very driven as an entrepreneur. I worked long hours all the time. I traveled a lot. I think it's a lot easier to be an employee father, where you're clocking out at 5 o'clock, doesn't really matter. You clock back in at 8 o'clock, you've got all this time. When you're an entrepreneur, there's really no clock, right? 5 o'clock means nothing to the entrepreneur. Weekends don't mean anything to the entrepreneur. It's all about, well, what do I need to do next to grow the business and focus on the business? Yeah, I would say my father role is probably not one to emulate for anyone, but is also, I think, very difficult to get around as an entrepreneur. There are not enough hours. I still feel that today. There's not enough hours in the day, enough days in the week to get done everything I still feel like needs to be done. Of things that I feel like I need to be the one doing them. It requires some real effort to stop and make time. I try every day now. Now 5 o'clock has come back to mean something to me. So I try every day, no matter what I'm doing, to get up. I walk away from the desk at 5 o'clock. Sometimes, often, I don't make it. I'm here a little later than that and have to go apologize to my wife for being late. But yeah, I don't know that I would recommend. I don't really know the path to being a good father as an entrepreneur. I don't believe that I was one. I mean, I wasn't like a mean or bad father. I was absent in mind and body.
Very vulnerable to say that. And I appreciate that lesson. I know that when I reached the point that I had to do it, that I intentionally designed businesses that wouldn't be that way. And I left an outrageous amount of money and opportunity on the table. And being forced to make that choice, I'm grateful for, at a time that I could execute around that. Because, and some of that technology stuff that I think makes a huge difference there. So if I could be more efficient and have people run certain things for me, then I could be at soccer games and decide not to travel and things like that. I still have that part of me that, hey, you're going to be at the next conference? I'm not going to be at a conference for 10 years. And what could I generate? What could I build? But I call my kids my organic startups, so that it helps to realign around, you know, hey, let's learn how to make money on eBay selling all that crap in your room, or try to bring that entrepreneurial thing home.
The wife of my children was an excellent mother, and I delegated all of that to her. And man, she was happy to do it, not happy that I wasn't there participating as much as she would have liked. But the kids all came out, all through college. They all did everything they needed to do. But I have to give her full credit for that. It wasn't me. I didn't do anything, pay bills.
You might be downselling a little bit, just like you did for the consulting, but you seem like that kind of guy that won't take the credit. So I'm going to give you a pass on it. I think if we had your kids here, maybe they'd sell a little bit of a different story now, but Fair enough. I'll give it to you. Before, and again, thank you for that. Those vulnerable shares are awesome for the audience. And yeah, I always learn something from it. And before I let you go, I like to ask every guest, you're a leader of a B2B organization, tech, otherwise, doesn't matter. But what, from your unique perspective, think of that radar screen on the submarine underwater or what have you, what's the blip that people should be paying attention to that's on your screen and maybe isn't on theirs? I'd like to draw the insights from each unique participant in this information journey that we have on this podcast.
Sure. That is going to vary significantly depending on where they are in their journey, if you will. And as I mentioned, in my 20s, I was an entrepreneur in my 20s and I was a big risk taker. But now in my 60s, still an entrepreneur, I'm not a risk taker as much as I was. So it's going to vary significantly what those two personalities see as the blip. I see a lot of things out there that I decide, yeah, if I was 20 years younger, I would probably chase after that. But where I'm at now, and I wouldn't be able to reach the goal of that before I want to stop what I'm doing. So I'm not even going to start down the path. So you can become much more selective about where you're going to invest your time, where you're going to invest your energy. And I think in the technology space in particular, I've seen too many companies, and this is more on our IP side of the business, that developed something. It was a good something. They made some good money on it for a while, and then it became no longer needed. Or someone else came along with better funding and built a better version of whatever it is you did. So you're on one side, you're looking forward to think about where's my next opportunity of something that I can accomplish with my capabilities in the time frame that makes sense for me. In the meantime, you're looking over here trying to defend what you have already built from people coming into the space. But we're still innovating. I mean, even in our services business, most every one of our competitors out there, including us up until recently, have all been on some sort of an hours-based model, right? You, the time and material or estimated number of hours to a fixed cost, whatever it is, but it all boils down in a services business to, I'm going to do some work for you for an hour, and you're going to pay me so much money for that hour that I worked. And that has been one that I have struggled with forever. And I never liked that model. I didn't like it as a buyer. I didn't like it as a seller of that model. And so we decided that we need to get rid of that clock. Somehow, my partner and I, we decided that clock is causing more problems for us and our customers because they can't take their eye off of it. They're going to argue about every invoice we ever send them. Our natural motion is to generate more of those hours, because that's how we make a living. And we're dealing with a customer whose motion is to buy fewer of those. It's an antagonistic situation. How do we get out of this? And so about a year and a half ago, we converted everything to a subscription model. And all you can eat services as a subscription model for the services that we provide for customers. They sign up, they pick a level of service that they want, they pick a term length, and that determines a fixed monthly cost. And then it's on the shelf. It went to accounting. They're just going to pay this fixed fee every month. There's no clock anymore. The clock is gone. There's not even any scope. Typical in our industry, it starts with a big, huge list of all these detailed requirements. That's because somebody needs to estimate how many hours it's going to take to perform all those requirements to give them a cost. So that's all blown up now. We're starting with customers with no scope, no clock, and it probably is the smartest business move I've made. We're making more money. Customers are all, frankly, spending less money, and they're all very happy, and we're very happy. It's one of those things where you look back and you regret things over the course of your business career. I regret not doing this much, much sooner than we did.
The blocker was it's built into us. Yeah, I agree. It's almost like the perception of risk for everyone and having to collectively get over that. And you talk about, like, any consultant trainer will tell you, you got to go value-based and there's all these things, but it's more just like, what we really are all looking for is, look, I want to pay the rent and you want to get stuff done. And can we just agree that let's take a leap together? Like, we might throw down for you sometimes. You might not get a great month other times, but it all is going to even out. But I think that comes from like a trust in your track. You can't pull that off if you're...
Yeah, and every vendor and customer is different, right? You've got customers out there who are hell-bent on getting the best possible, most value for the least money. They don't even care if they put you out of business. They could care less. So they're on that mission, and that's not a customer that anybody wants, but they're still out there. And I think that it may be the nature of the kind of a customer who's willing to, like you said, take that leap and say, okay, I'll sign up and pay you a fixed fee every month and see what happens. If they have that kind of mentality, then they're more apt to be happy with what's going on than if they came in the door saying, well, how do I know if I'm going to get $10,000 worth of work for $5,000 a month?
Ship your work to somebody else. Yeah. But I think what's really beautiful from the selling standpoint is that's just, it comes from a place of confidence. And if you aren't confident in this, then neither are we. And
yeah, exactly.
Because go to somebody else, because I have track record and I can prove it. And yeah. It forces you only to do business with the right clients, which is terrifying in a service business.
Even more so in that you can cancel any time, right? It's a subscription. You can cancel any time. If you hire me on a hour-based model, in the old model, we've got a contract that we've gone through, lawyers have looked at, everybody's agreed on his contract that I'm going to do this list of stuff and you're going to pay me this much money on this schedule. We've got a contract. You can't just get out of it because I'm going to do something else. No, we've got a contract here. You can't do something else. And there will be changes. There will always be changes in an agreement like that. It's too vague to start with. They think it's detailed, but it's really vague and there's lots of fluffiness in there. And then they're going to make realization new technology is going to pop up in the middle of a project to cause them to change direction entirely. Okay, now my contract says that's a change order, and I've got to give you a price for that. And you really don't have much of an option, customer, to accept whatever price I give you because we have a contract. So this is a very safe relationship for a partner. There's very little risk with a partner there. I've got a contract. The customer's taking all that risk. But when you move over to a model where maybe I'm taking more of the risk, but there's a shared risk in a model like this, it definitely changes the
trust-based orientation, which only comes from your confidence to sell based on your track record.
That's how subscription, any kind of subscription survives, whether it's a product subscription or a services subscription, is the customer can always cancel. They're making a decision every month that they want to continue working with you or not, and they have that option every month. It's not like a contract they signed up for a two-year deployment and they're stuck with you. They make a decision every month. They look at that bill that comes in and hits their credit card or the accounting department. They go, yeah, okay, I saw enough value. Let's keep going. So you have to have the confidence that they're going to see that, and we probably end up over-delivering because every single one of our customers renewed. So that probably tells me, okay, maybe we're doing more than we should be doing, but we're still doing fine, so no reason not to. But I think that's the other thing, is over-delivering, which I think we did because we wanted to make sure that this model would work and make sure they would renew.
Well, the incentives are aligned there. And of course, there are times where you get into those arrangements and there's no automatic increase over the course of a year, or inflation's a bitch or whatever. Like there are smart contract ways to manage those long-term relationships. I'd always encourage people to look at and design that way. What if this does last 5 years? What will I have wished for at that point? And there are smart ways to handle that, like a regular increase that happens every year. It's 5%. It accounts for average inflation, what have you. Like there's different, I got to pay my people more, all these things. So there are mistakes you can make setting out to do that right thing. But
yeah, I would say for anybody listening that's interested, we did write a white paper on services as a subscription model and how it compares to hourly and how to make a transition. They could get that at forceworks.com. It's a free white paper. It's 34 pages of basically what we learned going through the process, because nobody else had been doing it in our space before us. So we didn't really have anything to copy. We kind of had to make it up on the fly. And so that kind of summarizes what we've learned. So anybody wanting to make a transition, have at it.
That's fantastic. Thank you. Appreciate that. Yeah, absolutely. Forceworks.com. Go get that white paper, everybody. That's a good learning experience. I like that. Steve, I love the stories. I love the insights. Thank you so much for coming on and spending some time with us.
Happy to be here. I'm happy to do it again in the future sometime.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed this episode of the Leaders of B2B podcast. And as always, you can see more information about this episode and all the resources mentioned at leadersofb2b.com. If you enjoyed the show, please give us a 5-star rating. This episode is brought to you by Content Allies. We help B2B companies launch revenue-generating podcasts. We schedule interviews between you and your ideal prospects and strategic partners. You show up for engaging conversations, we handle everything else. Ready to build a podcast that grows your business in just 1 hour per week? Reach out to us at contentallies.com.